Hello, my name's Kate Rolls and I'm interviewing you for the Wellcome Trust as you're taking part in Anthony Gormley's new artwork, One and Other.
Hello.
Hello. The date today is the 17th of August 2009 and the time is 2:20 a.m. Can I please ask you to state your full name, your date of birth and where you come from?
Hello, my name's Chris Priest. My date of birth is 6th of March 1975 and I'm from Ripon in North Yorkshire.
How are you today?
I'm not bad, thank you. A bit nervous. not quite as tired as I thought I would be, which is a relief. But other than that, yeah, not bad at all.
Thanks. Good. Brilliant. What was it that inspired you to apply to be part of One Another?
It's a funny one, really. I was trying to work this out on the way down here today. I've been a fan, for want of a better phrase, of Anthony Gormley's work for a while. I think the first thing I ever saw was at the Royal Academy down the road, and I had no idea what I was going to see. I just sort of walked in and the courtyard was sort of full of bodies, for want of a better phrase, and it was one of the first things, I suppose, that ever really hit me quite hard in terms of artwork. So I remembered the name, and then sort of along the way I kind of picked up on other things that have come along, and obviously living in the North, Angel of the North becomes kind of a figure for a lot of people up there, and you've become very aware of it, and also the work up by Liverpool and the Sea and so on, so you end up picking it all up and very aware of Gormley's work over time. And then I think a friend just sent me an email saying, oh, did you know he's doing this and you can apply here, not really thinking anything would happen, I kind of clicked on the button and sent it off and didn't think about it again until I got the email. So it was a bit of a shock, if I'm honest, because I hadn't really thought it through terribly hard, but a pleasant shock.
Great. And then when you found out that you had got a place, how did you decide how to use your hour on the plinth?
Yeah, with difficulty. I think I got 3 o'clock in the morning as well. That made it more difficult for me. Lots of things I thought I might do didn't really seem worth doing at 3 o'clock in the morning. So in the end I sort of decided I would try and do some good. So I thought I'd try and come up with something that would raise money, and obviously again there's no point collecting money at 3 o'clock in the morning, so I needed to do it beforehand. Although really the idea for what I was going to do kind of came separately of the making money part, which was a feeling, I suppose, that I didn't want to be... I was clearly going to be on my own, and I felt that I wanted to be surrounded by people that I knew and loved and liked and so on, and there was no way, realistically, that they were all going to be there at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they certainly weren't going to be allowed on the plinth with me. So I came up with an idea of putting small figures on the plinth by my side to represent all of those people. And then I decided, if I'm going to be there at 3 o'clock in the morning, they should earn their place. So I asked if they could basically sponsor me. So each figure that gets on the plinth with me will have made a donation to Amnesty International. And I suppose the thinking behind it being Amnesty was I'd watched it online and seen some of the people up there already, and it struck me you had here someone who'd been plucked at random, placed in isolation in a confined space, surrounded by fencing with cameras looking at them. And, you know, the only kind of immediate comfort would be the thoughts of good people, if you see what I mean. And Amnesty just seemed a very obvious fit for that scenario. So that's why I went with that.
Okay. And you've got some figures then to represent your
yeah.
friends and family.
Yeah.
What are the figures made of?
Yeah, the figures are very simple. I toyed with all sorts of things. I had the idea, announced to everybody that this is what I was doing. And then had a minor heart attack when I realised I had actually no idea how I was going to do the figures themselves. I toyed with sculpting them, and then, well, number one, I'm no sculptor, and number two, that's clearly going to be very time-consuming and probably quite difficult to pull off. And I looked at sort of buying, you know, plastic figurines or something like that, but they were either very expensive or toy soldiers, and I didn't want to be surrounded by toy soldiers. I think it's probably enough in Trafalgar Square already. So ultimately, we've settled on what are simple kind of clothes pegs that people use for like making little peg people, and they paint them and dress them up. But actually, I've left them completely bare, just with a stand to keep them upright, because sort of looking at them, I just suddenly realised they looked quite Gormley-esque, really. They're quite sort of blank, clearly figures, but quite blank figures that you can sort of project onto quite nicely. And that sort of blank uniformity had an appeal to me in terms of representing all of these people. So yeah, that's what we've settled on in the end. And yeah, I'm quite happy with it, actually. I had some reservations at first, but having sat them around the house a little bit and looked at them, going, yeah, you work, that's great.
Have you done much practicing with this at home?
No, I really should have done. I tried to have a bit of sleep before I came today, and actually all that happened was I lay in bed going, why have I not been practicing this? The closest realistically to any practice that I've done was I started to make some notes, because one of the things I'm doing is for each person, every minute I'm going to try and lift one up onto a sort of miniature plinth, if you like, on top of the plinth, in some sort of perverse recreation of what's already going on. And so I tried to write down notes about the people and what I was going to say, and the genius that I am, those notes are at home. And I'm here, so I think I'm going to end up winging it. To be honest, that's probably the best way. I'm often more comfortable winging it anyway. And I think that probably gives a better representation of those people than carefully crafted notes that don't really mean very much. So we'll see what happens. You'll be able to find out afterwards whether that works out or not.
yeah, I look forward to it.
Yeah.
It's a lovely idea. Can I ask you to say a little bit about yourself? Yeah. I'll ask you that question very openly at first, just to sort of see what springs to mind for you when I asked you to say a little bit about you, about who you are as
yeah.
a person.
Where do you start with that question? I'm a dad, I'm a doctor, I come from Ripon at the moment. I think I do regard Yorkshire as home now. I grew up in Essex, but my dad's a Yorkshireman, so I spent a big chunk of my childhood being told that I needed to get back up north, and so did as I was told, really. But yeah, it's difficult. I think it's easy, I think, when you grow up to find yourself kind of defined by your job. I was sort of very careful there, I think, at the start, say I was a dad first and a doctor, but it's very easy to be defined by that, and I think particularly that sort of job description, very quickly everyone around you defines you by that. You know, everybody knows that's what you do, and treats you accordingly. But I think the things that matter to me, the job matters, but I think the other stuff does matter more. And having kids probably has changed my perspective on nearly everything in a way I hadn't imagined. And I suppose I'm still young enough and they're young enough to find that exciting and strange rather than life, which I think comes a bit later. So that's I think that's the biggest change in me. In terms of my family's, I'm quite lucky in that I have a really good relationship with my family, but for some people outside the family, I think that they find it odd sometimes. We're content just to kind of talk to each other when we see each other. We're not on the phone to each other all the time and all that kind of thing. As I say, we grew up down in Essex. I've got two brothers, one of whom had the immense misfortune of having to share a room with me for most of our formative years. I think we probably, out of all of us, I think the two of us that shared a room probably talk the least, because we just have nothing left to say to each other. And that's not a comment on our relationship at all so much as we don't need to do that. I think I'm probably, my parents split up when I was, about 12, something like that. And I think you kind of inevitably think of yourself as closer to one or the other. And I think at that time, initially, I kind of sort of pinned myself on my mum, who cared for us from there on in, and certainly I felt immediately closer to her, although as I grow up I realise I'm considerably more like my dad than I'd previously acknowledged to myself, I think. So that's quite strange, and then it all becomes horribly complicated after that. I've got sort of, you know, stepbrothers and sisters and a half sister and so on, but it's all good, and it's a pleasure because they're all nice people, which helps enormously. That's kind of a rambling answer to a very simple question.
It's not such a simple question.
No.
Are there any elements that you'd like to pick up on from that, and maybe say a little bit more about perhaps your kind of being a dad now, and you said that's really changed your perspective in many ways.
Yeah, it has. It does. I mean, I think before you have kids, everyone tells you it changes your life, and you roll your eyes and go, "Yeah, I know, yeah." And then you have them, and you understand what they were talking about, and you realise you didn't have a clue before. It's strange. I think before I had children, obviously, I knew what it was to love someone. I loved my parents. I loved my wife. But the sort of love you have for your children is very different. And very strange, very hard, and very wonderful. But it does completely overshadow everything and change your entire view of your life overnight. I often say to people, it's kind of, people think this is a horrible way of putting it, but it's true for me that you kind of die when you have a child, that the person you were just dies, they're gone, in the nicest way. And somebody new picks up from that point onwards, because I think your perspectives and your values completely alter, not quite overnight, but they do change substantially. And I think the other shock that I found when I had children was that it wasn't how people necessarily sold it. They all said it changes, but people either always told you about the negative, oh, you won't sleep, or they tell you about the positive, and oh, it's wonderful. And of course, it's exactly down the middle of those two. So when it's negative, you're wondering why it isn't as positive as everyone said. When it's positive, you wonder what on earth they were talking about when they said it was bad. But at the risk of repeating myself, it's just the strangest change in my life. And I mean, my eldest is 6 now. You'd think I'd have got used to it, but I haven't. I really haven't yet.
Can you see yourself in your children?
Yeah, I can. I can see myself in my children. Different asks of me. I mean, they're only 4 and 6, so you'd think they were a bit young for that. But no, I can very much see aspects of me in both of them, different aspects of me. Sometimes that's great, but for the most part, I'm quite self-critical, so it's not always good to see myself in them. I always say, "Oh no, don't do that. I do that. No, you don't want to be like me." But there are, in very different ways, and I'm sort of reluctant to go into that in too much detail, I guess, because it touches on them. I think that's not fair on them, really. But I think the other thing that's interesting is I understand my dad a lot better now that I'm a dad, and I understand how he felt a lot better than I did, and that's been a substantial shift for me as well. And in fact, just understanding parents in general, I think you kind of, you know, you spend most of your childhood thinking they're insane, and then you have children and realise, oh damn, they were right. And you suddenly have a great deal of sympathy for stuff you'd never had any sympathy for before.
Would you like to say a little bit about your wife?
Yeah. Oh, crikey. Helen's amazing. I always swore I would never go out with a doctor, and then I went and married one. We met at medical school, and we were friends for nearly the entire time of my training. Just really good friends. And for various reasons, I think it sort of gradually occurred to us that this was daft. Because we clearly loved each other in all other respects, and actually we just were right. And there were various things I think initially stopped anything happening, and then it just kind of naturally fell into place. And it's very strange for me, because I don't think I ever in my entire life actually asked anyone out. All relationships I've ever had have happened like that, but with Helen particularly so. It's interesting, my wife's parents are Bengali, so people ask me about, you know, sort of, are there cultural differences and things? I suppose there are between our parents, but then I think that's true of everyone's parents. But actually, I think between the two of us, we're pretty similar in most respects, with just enough difference to keep things interesting. I think it's difficult to talk about her without just being reduced to a bunch of cliches, really. Obviously, I love her enormously. I still feel proud walking next to her down the street in that slightly very sort of masculine, oh yes, aren't I? Ah, look at my beautiful wife, aren't I fantastic? And isn't she amazing? And haven't I done well for myself? But also just because she is my best mate. So it's just nice walking down the street with your best mate as much as anything. And very occasionally we treat ourselves and we have, you know, a couple of days away, just the two of us, and, you know, grandparents look after the kids or whatever. And that's just, it's so nice to go out and realise we really are still just best friends, and that I really do like you very much, and we're not just there for the kids and so on. So, there's nothing I can say that hasn't been said in 1,000 really embarrassing love songs. So I'll to some degree I'll leave it to them. But yes, I love her. She's great.
Can I ask maybe for you to say a little bit about your where you're from and what it was like kind of with your upbringing and growing up and how that maybe shaped you.
Yeah, growing up. I mean, I come from. Most of my childhood was spent either in a little village called Great Totham or a town called Malden, which is kind of just up the road. So they're kind of, in my head, they're joined together as the same place. And it was a nice place to grow up. I was a bit of a weird kid, I think it's probably fair to say. I started off as very shy, very, very introspective child. I remember when I was little, I was convinced that there was this giant invisible eye that followed me around. I'm sure this is probably diagnostic of something these days. I was convinced there was this giant invisible eye that followed me around and would see if I did anything wrong. So for years, I did nothing. And, I remember that one of the most formative moments in my entire life was stealing a pepperami from my friend's lunchbox. And the fact that the world did not end, nothing bad happened to me and no one found out about it, was this explosive revelation for me, which then led to a period of intense lying just to see what would happen, to the point that I managed to convince absolutely everybody that my poor mother had been shot in the leg at the train station, and which was deeply embarrassing when it became apparent that she hadn't. People were shaking her by the hand and congratulating on her bravery. At which point I kind of realised that wasn't a very good strategy for life either, and pulled back and kind of became a bit more introspective again, I think. And I was a very studious child. And then I came to 11 plus, and I failed the 11 plus on age, which was kind of interesting. A lad in my class had exactly the same score as me, but was 13 days younger, and he passed and I failed, and I remember everyone being terribly, terribly angry. But again, I think that it's probably one of the best things that ever happened to me, because I went to, rather than going to a grammar school where I think I would have been encouraged to remain studious, and where I think I probably would have had a fantastic career in research where I sat in a dark room for the rest of my life, I went to what I laughingly refer to as a proper school, where I couldn't get away with that, and I had to kind of come out of myself a bit more. And I think I was still, I was still probably a bit of a weird kid at the school, because I was still, that was still my leaning, but gradually started to come out of myself. And I think the right sorts of people, be they teachers, friends, whoever, gave me the right sorts of nods, and I got encouragement at home to kind of come out a little bit more. So I did kind of slightly more sociable stuff as I went along. I think I ended up being head boy somehow. I'm not quite sure how that happened. And I had meningitis and nearly died. And yeah, that put a new shine on everything as well. There's nothing like a bit of near death to kind of change your perspective on things again. I sort of spent a couple of days sort of veering between the hallucination and coma until they kind of got me sorted out. By all accounts was extraordinarily lucky, and I think as time's gone on and I've learned a bit more about it through work, I've realised quite how extraordinarily lucky I was. That that altered my view again. It made me a bit more carefree, which in the short term wasn't fantastic because I had my A-levels coming up and I really probably should have been studying a bit more. But it was that it certainly changed me. And then because I hadn't really been studying terribly hard, I didn't do brilliantly in my A-levels, which considering at that point I'd decided to become a doctor wasn't the greatest recipe for success. For various long-winded reasons, luck kind of went my way and I was able to get some money together to go to sort of one of these crammer things that they have in London and kind of try the thing again. And that again was a revelation because I enjoyed my school and I'd enjoyed my education and I thought everyone had done well by me. And I still think that. I think the teachers, in terms of shaping me as a person, had done an extraordinary job. Then I went to this crammer. I suddenly discovered that there are whole chunks of the population who are taught how to pass an exam. And my understanding of who does and doesn't do well in the world suddenly shifted. The realization that, yeah, sometimes you go to the right place to get the grades. You don't necessarily need to be the smartest guy in the world to get the best A-level. Equally, it works the other way around. You don't necessarily need to be stupid to not even get to that level. And this idea that I think I'd got because of being so studious that, that grades were everything and that your intellect and your skills could be measured in such a precise way just fell away very, very quickly with the revelation you could train pretty much anyone to it if you had the time and the money. I think those were all quite formative moments. They're all things that changed my view of the world a great deal. I think as a result, I'm a lot more open to a lot more things than I might otherwise have been without all of those events, some of which, in theory were probably bad. but I think nearly everything worked out in my favour. Even my parents splitting up probably worked out in my favour. So I've been quite lucky in that respect. It's curious because I regard myself as quite a pessimistic person and yet I look back and every bad thing, oh yeah, that was great. and yet my outlook on the world remains fairly glum. So I don't know why that is. I'm still faintly cynical about stuff, perhaps because of realising that some of the rules that we live by perhaps aren't entirely fair. And I think maybe that's where the cynicism comes from.
What about beliefs? Do you have any beliefs, religious or political?
Yes. I just don't really know what they are. Isn't that an awful answer? Religious beliefs is a difficult one for me. I think when I was a kid, I was really, really interested in all the Greek myths. I revelled in them. I really loved the stories. I'm a fan of stories anyway, and I really loved the stories. And then as I got older, there was this realization that these stories were things people believed, and that these were religions, if you like. And the realization that they were religions at a very, very early age kind of skewed my view of all other religions. And I think if you add to that the fact that, my mother is a Quaker, so I suppose Quakerism tends to encourage a degree of sort of open-mindedness about these things. But my mother is a Quaker. My in-laws are Muslim. My stepmother is Jewish. My best friend growing up became born-again Christian. I was surrounded by so many people who believed in so many different things that I ended up kind of not really rooting for anything. And I think ultimately I'm kind of open to anything. It's not even agnosticism per se. It's more I just don't know and I don't think it really matters. I think you just got to kind of, as that is what I believe. I believe that you need to just kind of look after each other, and frankly, if there's something afterwards, great. I'd like to imagine they'd look down and go, yeah, you were all right. And if there isn't something afterwards, well, great, life was good while it lasted. And I think that's the bottom line for me. I don't believe in religion, I think is my issue. I think anyone who tells you though the answers. Well, I don't know. I think most people who tell you they know the answers tell you that because they believe, and that's great. And I'm quite jealous. I'd quite like to believe. But I'm always slightly nervous of people who tell you that they know the answers and everyone else is wrong, whatever they believe in. And I guess, again, that comes down to what I believe. Politically, it's hard these days. I find it very hard to believe in a particular political movement because I think they've all kind of blurred somewhat over the last few years. And I think it's quite hard to pick and choose between one and another, which is a real shame because there are things I believe in. There are very basic principles that I utterly believe in. I believe in the rights of human beings, and I believe in looking after each other and all these sorts of things. But weirdly, I even have sympathy with politicians. I just don't necessarily feel there's any kind of there's certainly no political party at the moment that is sufficiently solid in what it believes in that I can feel I can pin myself to them. If one ever comes along, I probably become somewhat overzealous in my support, but to date I haven't seen one recently.
Are there any other kind of aspects of your life or sort of interests or passions that kind of help make up you?
I suppose I briefly mentioned I'm interested in stories. That makes me sound more interesting than I am, really. But when I was growing up, I wanted to be one of three things. I wanted to be a doctor or a writer or an actor. And being a child and being foolish, I convinced myself that the more difficult of these to become was a doctor. And so that was the goal I set myself. It's only now as an adult I realise that academically that might be the hardest, but actually in terms of getting there, I suspect the other two are actually infinitely more difficult. You know, success as a writer or an actor is much more difficult to achieve. My life is sufficiently filled that it's very difficult for me to do either of those things with the amount of commitment I would like. So I spend my life writing in my head. I've got far too many books kicking around in my brain, like most people, I suspect. And I spend my whole life going, yes, I'm going to write this, and it's going to be brilliant, and you're all going to love it, and it will be my message that I will leave for mankind when I'm gone. But whether I will ever actually get around to writing all things down, I've no idea. I sit down from time to time, and I start them, and people read them and tell me it's fantastic, and they can't wait to see how it ends, and then the kids are sick and work is busy and it falls by the wayside again. So I suppose it's both my eternal frustration and my kind of eternal pleasure. I love cooking these things up in my head, and they're kind of I think creation and the creating of things is one of the most important things people can do. I think it's really I think people dismiss it too easily. You know, people are always saying, well, what are we here for? And nobody really knows. But goodness, if you can make stuff, that's great. Surely that's at the very least, it's enhancing what's around you. And I sometimes like to imagine if you've created something, if you've imagined something that in some way, shape or form, you've made that real in some way. And so I have a great passion for that. And it's a great frustration in my life that I never managed to do anything with it, and I'm always slightly in awe of people who do, and I suppose that's partly why I'm here as well. You know, it's kind of, oh yeah, I at least get my foot in the door of something. I wish I could do that more, and at some point I will, I'm sure. My mother, who is now retired, has finally got around to writing her book. So who knows, you know. I'd quite like to think I could get around to it before I retire, really. If I had any other skills, if I could paint, I would paint. If I could play any instrument halfway competently, I would play. If I weren't the worst singer I know, I would sing. But as it is, those are completely lost on me, and words are pretty much what I'm left with.
How about your profession as a doctor, how are you finding that now that you are one?
Yeah, being a doctor, it's funny. It's a bit like having a kid, but in reverse, really. When you're growing up, I think people have an idea about doctors that it's this incredibly important, glamorous, fantastic, life, world-changing job. And it's a job. I hate to say it. I think it's probably... And I don't think everyone feels like that, necessarily. But I think at the end of the day, in many respects, it is a job. You know, you go to work, you fill your time at work, and you go home again. Does that mean I don't love it? No, I adore it. I don't think I've ever had a day at work where there hasn't been a moment where I've thought, yeah, this is why I'm here. And it's an enormously privileged job. The stories that I hear from people, the lives that I come across, are incredible. And again, it's another thing that makes me realise how amazing everybody is. You wouldn't believe, and I can't tell you, but you just sit there and you look at people and you think, how did you manage that? How did you get through that? How are you here talking to me about that? And some days you do the opposite and you're like, why are you here telling me about this? This is, you know, and I quickly realise how different we all are. I think there's it is extraordinary. You have to kind of catch yourself occasionally. And I'm a GP. I'm nothing spectacular. You know, I'm not a neurosurgeon or anything. But in many ways, I wouldn't want to be. I am interested in it's the people as much as the kind of the science or anything like that that always drew me to the job. And whilst making people well is a substantial part of it and part of the pleasure of it, I think also those relationships that you build up is a big part of it. And if I'm honest, as a GP, making people well it's rare that I get to save a life as such. Maybe in the long run, you know, you do things that might save someone's life. You can't say, oh yes, I started this tablet, and 20 years later go, yes, I saved you. So it is much more about those relationships, and it's much more about helping people to understand what's going on. You know, a headache is terrifying if you don't know why you've got a headache. And I don't think you can actually underestimate how important that is. That actually is quite satisfying, you know, to sit and say something, look, really, you don't have a brain tumour, this is just a regular headache. And it's sometimes easy, I think, as a doctor to forget that that's what it's like. You know, to forget that if you've not even had a cold before, then a cold is scary. You know, I see colds all day. But people are terrified, you know, people come see you with a cold and are absolutely terrified. And again, I think it just rams home that every single person is so different in their experiences in their life, what they will put up with, what they won't put up with, and how they view the world. And it's an absolute privilege to do that, a huge privilege to do that.
Is there anything else that you would like to say further about taking part in one another before we close?
Thank you very much, really. I haven't done it yet, so I might take that back in an hour's time. But no, thank you very much. It's just a fantastic opportunity to be here for the reasons I've bored you with for the last however long. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm absolutely terrified, but I'm really looking forward to doing it. And it's great just to take part in something like this. So thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.